My name is Jeff Lerner, and I interview elite performers from a wide range of disciplines, entrepreneurs, athletes, celebrities, scientists, artists, and more. This is Unlock Your Potential. Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Unlock Your Potential. Jeff Lerner, your host, always so excited to be back with you, having amazing conversations with amazing human beings. Today, I am joined by Jason Lang. He is the founder and president of Bloomboard. He has spent his career trying to understand how best to leverage technology to create a meaningful education experience for all kids. And he's the founder and president, obviously, of Bloomboard, which is tackling the education problem. And we'll spend a lot of time unpacking what I mean by that. I do want to quickly set up that I don't know how many podcasts Jason does. You know, he's not like one of those guys that's on the circuit from what I know and is constantly doing these. This is something I had a great conversation with Jason. How many months ago was that, Jason?
Three months,
yeah, maybe.
3 months.
And I was like, dude, let's do that again and then some for an audience. Like, it was so powerful. It was about education, which we're both passionate about taking on systemically. And I'm really excited about this conversation, Jason, and grateful you were able to be here.
Love it. Really appreciate you having me in. Excited.
Just some quick context. So at Entra, my audience is all familiar with Entra. Our chief product officer is a gentleman named David Brubacher, who used to work with Jason in your organization. I don't actually know what role. I assume maybe it was a CPO or as a product.
Yeah, he was head of product.
Okay, at Bloomboard. And Brew, as he's known, connected me and Jason because we're both very passionate, obviously, about education reform, and thought we would be fast friends, which turned out to be true. So that's how we got here. And Jason, I'm grateful to have you here. Why don't you maybe just start for the audience? I'm trying to like remember all the amazingness of our first conversation. I know I was sitting at a gas station. I was like, I needed to fill up my car, and I ended up sitting at the gas station for an hour because I didn't want to fill up my car. I didn't want to interrupt the conversation. So, we were deep into deep waters about education. What's going on with education? Why don't you just kind of set us up? Like, who are you? How'd you become passionate about this challenge? Maybe define the challenge as you would, and then we can go from there.
Yep. Sure. So I grew up outside Chicago, sort of a middle income, sort of typical suburban, you know, sort of good government family. And I did not really know what I wanted to do, like most kids these days, right? And most kids in general, like, just had no idea what I wanted to do. My parents, my mom in particular, had been very adamant about, I need to go to Harvard and go to the Ivy League because, like, education was the future of all things. And I was sort of always like, whatever, fine. Like, it's interesting. But I was fortunate to play football fairly well. And I think had enough foresight that I was a, you know, above average size and height and weight sort of person who is not going to go to the NFL. And so if I could go play football in the Ivy League, that was going to be pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Yale to play football. And I thought I could get in on my own until I worked in the admissions office and realized fairly quickly that that was not a true statement. I got a very quick crash course in just the difference in mainstream public school, high school education and what my peers at Yale had been going through in terms of rigor and academics and content. And it was the most culture shock of, right, sort of a world I could have imagined. And I didn't quite fail out my freshman year. I hung on, but it was a brutal sort of initial orientation into that world. And it just made me my parents had moved to our community because they thought that we had very good schools. And right, it was not sort of the case of what I had sort of realized. And it just made me sort of question, like, what happens if you go to a bad school in the reality, in the world we live in? And where do you end up as a, you know, from a career potential standpoint, given all of the systemic systems that we live in that are pretty biased and, right, structurally flawed in terms of trying to help people unlock their potential? And so I think that was a pretty interesting, jarring experience. I ended up doing teacher prep while I was an undergrad. Loved education. I am pretty much an elementary school teacher at heart. For any of my friends who know me, like, I like to play with, you know, I like to play more than most people in general. And so I just sort of, the idea of like being able to sort of be an elementary school teacher sounded awesome. My mentor said, look, you can always go back in education. You should go get a real job, which was fascinating way to put it. And so I went into finance, spent a bunch of time there and just realized that it was just it felt like a very soulless place where you just make money for the sake of making money. And so I wanted to go back and really try and understand how can I help education the most? This is sort of a future, or this will be the rest of my career. And technology is gonna be a thing. This is sort of mid-2000s. And so I went back to grad school and really spent the entire time, and was fortunate to get in Stanford, where they have this joint degree in the business school, the School of Education, but basically spent the entire time just trying to figure out, how does technology actually help kids the most in the future? And what will that look like? And that has been now we're almost 14 years in the Bloomboard journey and learning all that. And so it's been an interesting time just trying to figure out what it will it take and how can technology actually create leverage, in particular in terms of improving teaching, because we know that's all of the research suggests that the quality of the teacher in the room, other than zip code, basically is the best. The quality of the teacher is the best predictor of outcomes for kids. And so the question is, how do you build really great teachers and really great instruction at scale, which as of today is still in an unsolvable or yet to be solved problem. And that's what we've been doing for the last many years.
So is it fair to say, you hear Yale, then you hear Stanford Business School, you hear, funded company founder, there's a number of things that you're like, oh, we're clearly talking about a silver spoon kid, right? And you're like, no. I was the average kid or the ordinary kid who unlocked these types of opportunities because of athletics. But you also, it's interesting, you were good enough to unlock those opportunities, but also self-aware / not good enough to have a delusion that football is going to be my whole life.
Totally.
Right. And so that's really interesting. So I'm always really interested in life narrative and how the stories all, I believe that we come pre-installed from the factory with a purpose for being here. And it's always interesting to live the lived experience that decodes that.
Yeah.
So it's like you were meant to go to a good enough school to prepare you to get into Yale combined with football, but not so good a school that you couldn't tell the difference once you got there between how these kids have been groomed and how you had.
Yeah.
Maybe talk a little bit about, because I actually, it's interesting. I'll tell you straight up. I went to an elite prep school.
Yeah.
Right. We had four perfect SAT scores I actually got kicked out my sophomore year, so I'm no great success story. But in what would have been my senior class, I think we had four perfect SAT scores in a class of 120 people. I mean, I went to a really elite school. And so I don't actually, but then my junior year, because I got kicked out, I had to go to the public school across the street, and that which was also considered to be a fairly good public school. And that was my little window of exposure to what you're talking about. Like, for people that went to public school, even a good one, there's a whole other level of education that people with elite backgrounds have access to.
Totally.
Yeah. So maybe talk about that.
Yeah, it's just a weird, I feel like in general, right, I have said time and time again, I am by sort of academic standards from my friends, certainly from Yale, from in general, I am average, right? And I can certainly I like to read and I'm super curious, but as a pure horsepower lens, it's just not close relative to the people that that were my classmates. I think what I realized early on was I knew how to work really hard, and I knew that I feel like I was sort of overcoming, all right, because I'm average, I'm going to have to work really hard to sort of, make this work. And that's what I'm going to use to try and get ahead. But I've looked back even today, this is the fundamental weirdness in society. It's a place like Yale just fundamentally changes the trajectory and the options and the things that you can do by virtue of its network in the system that it lives. And that was an unbeknownst, getting in to play football was awesome, right? And I feel like I made the best absolutely I could out of my experience, and I met more people and have more sort of connections than I could have ever thought possible. But the idea that that single instance in life set me on a different path than I possibly, I got into finance and into investment banking when I had no business getting into finance and investment banking, because I went to Yale, because I played football, and I got into private equity because I was in investment banking because I went to Yale. And I got into Stanford because I was investing in private equity because, and so
right.
the trajectory just sort of sets a different sort of level. But it is some of this question of like, they're from a, just like a pure like talent level, right? Other than like, I like to work a lot and work hard, right? There's not, I would not sort of put any sort of extraordinary level of preparation on top of that. And I think that's part of my, been one of my sort of key passions of like thinking about education, which is like, that's something I feel like every kid should understand and realize and learn at some point in life. But unfortunately today, like that's just not the case, right? We have only half of kids now graduate high school, half that graduate high school, half don't graduate college. And there is a bunch of stigma and bias against, sort of, this idea of like who you are is just set and you're just not smart enough, not able to do enough. And like, that's just not true, especially in the world we live in today. And so it's really trying to figure out how do you redesign an education system that can both sort of remediate that and really show kids that they have pretty much unlimited potential and figure out, how do you sort of then build some of these barriers and bridges into the sorts of opportunities that I've had because of the brands that I've been in.
Yeah, it's interesting, man. This is like a fundamental social question of opportunities. Luck is when opportunity meets preparation. And I mean, you talk about no matter how much we want to say I'm a self-made man.
Yeah.
Like our preparation is itself a type of luck,
exactly.
Especially when we're younger. And I'll tell you what came to mind as you were sharing, and the audience obviously knows my story fairly well, much of the audience. And by the way, if you're new and you don't know my story, thank you for being here. I'm glad to have a first-time listener. But, I was a musician. I dropped out of high school and became a piano player. And during my time playing piano, I was exposed. I had all of my best gigs were in the homes of entrepreneurs. Like I used to get invited to play these private parties for Jim Crane, who owns the Houston Astros, Tillman Fertitta, who owns the Houston Rockets, Bob McNair, who owned the Houston Texans. I played for all the major Houston sports teams owners in their house. And what I connected the dots is, these are all entrepreneurs. And that's when I was like, okay, because I kind of like you, I'm good enough to play at this level, but like, I'm not going to be the next Billy Joel. So yeah. I was inspired to explore entrepreneurship because of these clients that hired me in the piano. But what really I hadn't connected the dot on until you just planted the seed is how did I get those gigs? I was like a 24-year-old, up and coming young piano player booking into the highest end social circuit private parties you can get in Houston, Texas, where I make $1,000, sometimes $1,500 to go play piano for 4 hours in somebody's house. The answer is because the lady that owned the booking agency that booked those gigs, who is herself very socially connected, very entrenched in that scene, I went to school with her daughter. So she knew who, even though I was a high school dropout who became a piano player, at least I still was able to get a foot in the door to get those gigs that inspired me to do other things. And it's crazy. Like every success story, there's a level where if we're honest with ourselves, we have to say, hey, at least at that moment, I got lucky, right?
Totally.
And so, and perhaps it takes somebody who's aware of that to say, okay, I want to try to level this field for everyone. So I applaud you for taking that on, especially walking away from the lure of private equity. I know so many people in that space that like it's always a little bit more, a little bit more.
And then I'll
go do my mission or my calling. But first a little bit more money, a little bit, this one more IPO or whatever. So props to you. Tell us about Bloomboard. Was that your first? Is this your first venture? As a founder?
It is. And we're obviously 14 years into it. And so it's been an interesting journey. In the early days of our world, a lot of it came down to we were just trying to figure out how to, again, this whole, I had done a bunch of work in grad school around where's the leverage, right? And as from an investing standpoint, right, the whole sort of game in life is what's the thing that you can do that can get 10x'd and do better that makes it sort of really work and what makes the system hum? And the fundamental crux of the education research is that teachers are the leverage. And if you can build really great teachers, you can reach hundreds of kids in much better ways. And it's where all of the gains can happen. And yet the systems we have to build great teachers and to train teachers are pretty awful, just flat out. And so the initial thesis of the company was, let's build basically an Amazon marketplace for teacher training to figure out what training is actually most helpful. So we built this whole marketplace. We raised millions of dollars of Gates funding. I used to get to present to Bill Gates personally on the future of tech and ed tech, about sort of the work we were doing with the foundation. And the whole idea was, let's sort of have teachers, we gave them millions of dollars, let's just have them spend money in a marketplace and see what helped their practice and actually their instruction and what helped change their kids' outcomes, their sort of improve their scores the most. And none of it worked. It was like 4 years of like grinding, trying to sort it out. And we just couldn't get much change in practice. And what we found is teachers just, they're busy and they're right, normal human beings. They have a ton going on. And the idea that they're going to get some amazing training that's going to help them change their practice just doesn't happen because so much of it is a checkbox. And we just couldn't find much that was moving needle, except when we actually asked them to videotape themselves. And we showed that, like, and we gave them annotated timestamped feedback on their actual videos. And people would say to us, holy cow, this is crazy helpful and useful. And I know now I can see why I didn't connect with that kid quite well. I can see why I could have done this routine or this sort of, you know, sort of instruction, this lesson better. And that was a really powerful moment. It actually, from a football lens, brought me back to like, I watched every practice and every game and every game, every competitor I've ever played in has ever played in. Because like in football and in sports, video is ubiquitous. We use it for everything because it's the best way to see objective reality from a third party perspective and really see why it happened the way it happened. And we don't do that in the workplace today. And we certainly don't do that in teaching, even though teaching is a very much a performance based profession. And so the idea that we were just trying to push video into the actual sort of classroom experience and the teacher learning experience, that was a really interesting shift. The fundamental problem was when we first started doing it, it was just too vulnerable, right? You know, again, most people don't like watching themselves on video, shockingly. And so the idea that we were going to have somebody upload a video to the black box of the internet where an expert was going to give them feedback and potentially tell them they're not as good a teacher as they think they are, that was really scary. And the idea that if they did that, we were just going to give them the same credit as if they went to a conference and hung out in the back of the room and sort of checked their phone, that wasn't a great incentive. And so I then spent many years basically trying to rewrite law in the country for licensure policy, which is sweet. I would not recommend that. But, you know, we were able to do enough sort of licensure policy work to then get higher ed to really sort of perk up and say, like, okay, well, what if this video-based sort of approach to learning, what if we could make that part of the degree and take our existing, you know, sort of sit and get degree model? And what if we could sort of swap that for an actual job-embedded video portfolio-based degree? And we started doing that a few years ago, probably 4 or 5 years ago. And at a master's degree level, it took hold and was really interesting in terms of helping retain teachers. And now we just started then, you know, a bunch of our superintendents and districts came to us and said, that idea for a degree at a master's level, can you do that for bachelor's degrees? Because turns out we have, you know, a million plus, right, millions of sort of folks in our schools today that are in classified roles, right, cafeteria staff, right, paraeducators, subs, who have been some of these candidates who just have been locked out of higher ed, right, for whatever reason. They didn't get a bachelor's degree in the normal course when they were 20. And turns out when life moves on from the normal higher ed system we live in, it's really hard to go back. And that doesn't have any, you know, implication or sort of judgment on like the quality of the candidate. We have some amazing candidates, educators, who for whatever reason, they either dropped out of college or didn't go to college because of family, because of cost, because of lots of other circumstance. And getting back into the system is pretty much impossible in the traditional sense if you've already got a family or you're working two jobs. And so all of a sudden, the idea that we could start to partner with higher ed and actually design a new delivery for their degrees that's entirely embedded in your day job and that's entirely based on actual videos and lesson plans and the work that you're doing with your kids to confer the same 3-credit course that I took in very much a sit and get lecture classroom. That's a really amazing shift. And so we're starting to create a new sort of pipeline into the teaching profession today that is unlocking, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of new sort of teachers that historically just haven't been able to actually get into the profession. And given, you know, there's always news about the teacher shortage today. So it's sort of solving one of the hardest problems for districts and doing it at a pretty crazy, interesting scale.
Man, that's so cool. So essentially, instead, what you're saying is, hey, you can get a degree in teaching by spending 4 years teaching, as opposed to getting a degree in teaching by spending 4 years sitting, learning, and not teaching.
Exactly. And that's really, and so I think that's going to change. And this gets into, I think, where we, you know, as Dr. Glass was like, we're going to see that change in large part in the education system as a whole, right? And you're seeing, whether it's the IBMs and the Facebooks, like folks that are trying to not only undo their bachelor's degree requirements, but then ultimately they're just pulling candidates into their own training programs. Because at the end of the day, right, corporations, now employers, are now realizing that their human capital pipelines is a key part of their supply chain. And like any good corporate, you know, corporate organization, if something jeopardizes your supply chain, if you can't hire enough talent to do your work, then you're going to go acquire that part of your supply chain. And so we're just seeing corporations move into the higher ed world in really interesting ways. And so the question will be is, how does higher ed now respond to that? And how do they partner with employers? And we're seeing this obviously in computer science programs and other sort of tech areas. But I think applying that same logic to teaching, and we're now seeing this in nursing as well, right? We're going to see the idea of a job embedded degree as much more the norm for the future. And if you're, it makes logical sense. Like, why would you spend 4 years sort of partying and having fun and like going off doing something that isn't connected to an actual career if you could be making money that whole time and not taking on debt? And so that's, I think, a big, powerful shift that's going to play out in the next 5-10 years here.
Yeah. And you think about, for the employer, I mean, the average tenure of employment now is something like 20 months. I mean, people are quitting, changing jobs every 2 years. You know, imagine you attend, you know, Google starts recruiting, you know, scouting the high schools for the best talent, popping them right into Google University, where they basically major in how to be of value for Google. And then they come out of that and they're hyper qualified to work at Google. They're probably not going to quit their job at Google after 20 months. It's a way better retention vehicle for employers. And Google's an easy example, but I mean, you know, let's take a school. Like, I think of it at the University of Houston, where I attended, the School of Hospitality was called the Conrad Hilton School of Hospitality. It was one of the best hotel management schools in the country. But why the hell would Hilton put their name on a building at U of H when they could just have the Conrad Hilton School of Hospitality?
Yep. And I think that's really the crazy, right? The idea that all of a sudden they can just get a lot more ownership, because there is a bunch of weird, you know, higher ed, as much as people like to bash higher ed is also beholden to a bunch of inputs that they just don't get to control. Mm-hmm. And so there are a bunch of these sort of weird systemic structures that, right, there's not a lot of leeway to innovate and move in higher ed today. And I think that's actually what, you know, when we're in the factory model of just trying to churn out people to sort of get into the workforce, and there were so many jobs, right? And there was sort of, you know, we weren't at underemployment to where it is. We just didn't have the systemic pressures that we have now, where corporations were going to duke it out, and where they're now saying like, all right, like, I'm going to go try and build this in the best version possible, because the Hilton version of their degree, or right, the Accenture or the Google version of their degrees, they're going to be pretty specialized, but they're also going to be really valuable for those candidates, because they're going to have a ton of the relevant training to go wherever they want to go once they're up and done and paid for.
Yeah. And I mean, it also solves the student debt crisis, which is insane. I mean, when I was writing my book, I did all the research on student debt. And I mean, I think it's the largest single asset of the U.S. government is its portfolio of student loans that it took over as part of the Affordable Care Act, which was supposed to be about healthcare reform, but it also federalized all student debt. Like, it's, there's a whole racket that this also seems to at least be a solution for. So I mean, first of all, like, super fascinating stuff. I'm thinking kind of the interests of the audience, right? Like, the interest of the audience is really probably of two sorts. I don't know how many kids listen to this podcast, so I don't mean to exclude them from the statement, but at least for the adult cross section of the audience, it's either, okay, well, I want to learn new skills so that I can unlock different possibilities for my life, or I want to better understand the educational landscape so that I can prepare my children for a future that none of us know, right? Let's maybe start with the second. Like, even as a question, like, well, I know you have kids, like what are you, yeah, I mean, how has this impacted your own choices as a parent in terms of what's out there for education and or any counsel you would give to others about that question?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. I think for my kids, and again, I would say, like, I am very aware of, like, obviously the bias that I bring in terms of the networks and the, right, sort of degrees that I have. And so It is easy for me to say, like, oh, like, I'm less concerned about college, given that I have those networks. I would say, I think nowadays the world we're living in is moving so fast. And if you just look at where, like, ChatGPT and AI, these tools are, it is much more of a question, I think, to, you know, young adults nowadays, or adults in general, is like, what actually do you get excited about and what are you passionate about? And frankly, there's just, it's so much easier to make a living and a reasonable living in things that you're passionate about and have a really happy life doing it than trying to chase, I think, a lot of what, you know, when I was growing up, this idea of, like, trying to chase the, like, how do you get rich? How do you sort of, you know, get something? It's like, how do you create wealth? And that's just a world where, because of the way the internet works and because of your ability now to solve problems and use AI to solve problems, that where you just can sort of apply a much better level of pattern recognition. And so it's helpful to be more of a generalist. There's a great book I just finished called The Range. That's all about this idea of, right, how do you sort of solve gnarly problems? And there's whole websites dedicated to lay people solving corporate problems using just novel ideas that people never even thought of were possible because they just had an outsider's perspective. And I think the idea of trying to sort of help, so when I talk with my kids, it's really this idea of college is not necessarily the thing that they need to worry about. I actually did a little sort of 10X talk on it, right, why I don't think all four of my kids will go to college. Because, like, I don't think it's really needed anymore. And I think at the end of the day, there's going to be a lot of options to say, well, if you want to go into corporations, if you want to go travel and sort of teach and go sort of create nonprofits and go build companies, right, college may not be the best experience for you because it's a pretty long journey away from doing the work these days. And so that's, again, where if your work is your college, well, that's pretty interesting. That seems like a pretty compelling case. But it's definitely a place where, you know, there's a certain set of, you know, say, candidates that are always going to want to go to college and have the experience. But I think there's a whole bunch of candidates that's just not the world that they want. And you can have a ton of fun in your, you know, late teens, 20s, and still, like, go do great work and go work on really hard problems. That's a ton more fulfilling. And that fulfillment piece, we haven't had a lot as much of in prior generations in terms of sort of focus on what that is.
Yeah, I really look at the long arc of human development. I mean, I'm very excited about technology. I'm excited about tech. You know, technology gets a lot of hate, let's say, but fundamentally, technology is how we raise the floor on the standard of living. I mean, it's like let's you and I's life is novelly impacted by technology. A poor person's life has been fundamentally transformed by technology in the last 100 years, right? Yeah. And so that's why I'm such a big fan. And I love, but with that, I love what you're saying, that it sort of unlocks a much broader swath of people now have, call it, the luxury to ask fulfillment-oriented questions rather than merely survival and or family indoctrination alignment-oriented questions like, my son's going to be a doctor, damn it, you know, or he's going to be dead if he disobeys me, right? Like, yeah, it's a really, really cool direction we're going. So within that context of, let's just call it progress, I'm curious, it seems like whenever there are these sort of large institutional problems, let's call it, that there's a certain amount of creative destruction that is highly desirable. It's like, we got to tear all this stuff down so that we can reinvent it better for the future. And then there's all this, you know, resistance from entrenched interests who benefit from maintaining status quo. I know that dynamic is at play in education. I've done a fair amount of research on it for my book, particularly around student debt, around university like curriculum and credentialing models, how course catalogs and syllabi get put together, and how those committees work. Like, there's a lot, but I don't pretend to know nearly as much as you do. So I'm wondering if you could kind of walk me and the audience through, like, here are how the entrenched interests are propping up a broken system and slowing us down from evolving to a better one. Hey there, real quick, I just wanted to let you know, I have been concentrating a lot lately on providing tons of value to my text message community. This could be random thoughts, this could be letting you be the first to know about an event I'm planning or a special I'm running or a free training I'm hosting. Anyway, just shoot me a text to get subscribed. The number is 702-996-3926. Thanks so much. Let's get back to the podcast.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's a question of, right, where, you know, often it comes from sort of where is the cultural zeitgeist, right? It's at its core, right, sort of higher
and where's the money?
And where's the money, right? Yeah. And so at its core, right, in a world where the path that we've told kids, and this is part of the education, I think, weirdness that we're living in this unique period is for a decade, right, in 2000, we started telling all kids, you need to go to college. College is the key. College is the key. College is the key. That's the only thing that matters.
That was No Child Left Behind was like 2000, right? Yeah.
That's the whole game, right? That's the sort of the whole function. And obviously with that comes a bunch of the debt, a bunch of the other sort of loans, other subsidized things, and some of the weird self-serving interests of like non-forgivable loans, even in bankruptcy, all the ridiculousness. I think what we're seeing now is sort of folks realizing like there's so many fundamental, like there's just so many candidates, so many students who are graduating who have a friend or a relative, right? Or someone they know who's graduated and doesn't know what they want to do and doesn't feel particularly well prepared and doesn't feel like they actually have materials and they're working in retail, you know, right? In a place where they don't feel like they've got a ton of upward mobility. And that has started to crack that sort of cultural zeitgeist and really started to open up this idea of, well, maybe college isn't for everyone. And sort of, it's not sort of managing to write that expectation, but maybe there are other more entrepreneurial ways to go to do that. So I think that's sort of the cultural change is one that we can't navigate. We're sort of not really seeing. I think the other big one that's interesting is just sort of like the exclusivity component, you know? So in the, I don't know how many at this point, given all the consolidation, there's whatever, the 3,000 higher ed institutions in the country, really, there's only about 250, 300 that actually have admissions rates that are below 50%, which means in that scenario, like there's only, right, in those institutions, so vast majority of colleges and universities pretty much take all comers, right? And if you're able to pay, shockingly, right, they're happy to have you because, right, it's a tuition game going on. I think the question there becomes, what then colleges are wrestling with is that's going to create a pretty interesting, right, separation because, right, the more exclusive you are, the more people want to go, right? And those top 250, they're all the ones with big endowments and they're all the ones who's sort of growing enrollment and managing the process. And if you're not in that category, right, it's a question of like, well, how are you going to differentiate and survive? And how are you going to make the leap to try and get into that area? And that's where I think we're seeing a lot of either consolidation of those systems today, and we're seeing a lot of this innovation come up where folks are really trying to specialize into employer-based programs, right, into other areas, because it's really trying to think about, right, not only is the enrollment cliff real, right, people are just having fewer kids than we built, you know, dorms for in the higher ed space, but ultimately it's about like, how do you now sort of build some level of differentiation for that smaller population, right? And now if we've got, right, a much larger population that's really trying to sort of access other options, how do we keep degrees relevant and keep them plugged in to making it really work? And that's, I think, the big question that higher ed's wrestling with. It's like the degree currency is still real for the time being. And I think that we have a chance to keep it relevant because there's definitely value there in terms of, you know, portability and like validation and real sort of academic backing and research. It's sort of like, it's always like, you know, standardized testing isn't a bad thing in its own right. It can be used as a force for evil sometimes, but it's not inherently, right? It's about sort of a bar to try to understand how kids are doing. And so it's really the idea that degrees have all of the benefit of creating a more standardized sort of currency, which should exist and can help propel people to, right, much greater prosperity. It's just a question of how to sort of integrate that into something that feels really tangible and useful in someone's trajectory in life versus something that sort of feels like it's an accumulation of debt and going to be something that's going to be hard to get real ROI on.
So is there, if you look at all the different stakeholders, whether it's alumni, corporate donors, educators, administrators, policymakers, students, parents, is it all at a, and this is a little bit of a reductive question, but like at a macro level, is it all a bunch of well-intended people that are all sort of collectively fumbling their way through a period of rapid change in ignorance of the future? Or is there actually like a nefarious adversarial player within that mix that is like obstructionist and protectionist of the status quo?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's easy to villainize an education because the system feels so poorly designed. I think I would, in the end of the day, like vast majority, right? So they're always going to be bad actors. But I would say the vast majority of people in higher ed and people in education and teachers in general, like really want, are well-intended and want the best for kids and want the right outcomes. And I think what has happened is, right, we've layered this system of bureaucracy on top of systems of bureaucracy that no longer actually sort of represent the reality of the world that we're living in, given technology and given time and space. And so the systems we have just are designed to adapt. And so what that looks like is somebody saying, well, this is the system. These are the standards and the competencies I have to teach to, because this is what our accreditation is set up as. And yet somebody saying, well, but that accreditation was set up, or that sort of those standards were set up 30 years ago, before the internet. And like, how are we sort of thinking about, right, what that means? I think in a lot of the ways we're seeing this sort of, you know, the pendulum swing. You know, liberal arts has gotten all this backlash because it hasn't been useful in the liberal arts sense. But like, now that like AI is, you know, starting to change and really think about, right, how coding and different things, like, you know, engineers themselves are getting replaced by AI, which is fascinating because Copilot and other tools can really do a ton of heavy lifting. And in that case, then really this idea of like liberal arts critical thinking skills and being able to sort of pattern recognize across context and try to solve problems, that does become really interesting. And so I think it's trying to figure out, you know, how do you build complex systems to manage scale and make them adaptive? And fundamentally, that's the crux that we don't have. We just don't have adaptive bureaucracy in a way that can allow for even a large pool of well-intended people to want to do good work, because it is, you know, the number of times you'll hear people in education say like, well, that's just not the way we can't do it that way. That's not the way it's ever been done. Because those are the systems we have to try and uphold, you know, some level of rigor and some level of bar. But those are the same systems that then we end up fighting with in order to actually innovate.
So you actually use the term adaptive bureaucracy that I've never heard before, because I fear it may not even exist. This might have been just an oxymoron. But no, so I'm curious, you know, one of the proposed solutions I've heard, I feel like this is Vivek Ramaswamy, the presidential candidate, has basically said, I would abolish the Department of Education. That there's a sort of an ideology that this non-adaptive bureaucracy, or the bureaucratic nature of education as a whole, sources back to about 100-year-old, 100 or 200, depending on how, or you could even go back all the way to the Protestants. Well, there's 19th century Catholic immigration is what pushed the Protestants to say, hey, the government needs to start to standardize schooling because we got to protect against the parochial schools. And then in the early 20th century, it became more overtly like Prussian and factory styled. But that basically for the last 200 years, we've been making decisions as a country that made the present state inevitable. And the only way to undo the present state is to actually undo those foundational decisions. Curious your take.
Yeah, I feel like it's a step too far, right? I feel like there are very clear, very valuable, right, systems in place that the federal government can provide, especially in terms of the most marginalized, needy populations, right? And so certainly in a middle street, middle America, right, middle market, right, sort of middle income population and higher income populations, the Department of Education doesn't have any bearing, right? Because at the end of the day, right, middle income families are going to do what they're going to do, right? They have private options, they have vouchers and other systems. The problem is market systems are very good at navigating, right, sort of the wealthy, right, and navigating sort of the middle income folks, but they're really bad in safety nets and they're really bad in navigating sort of high need populations. And so, like, the idea that, especially post COVID, where we have more and more kids going into IEPs and special education plans because they're just frankly behind because they lost a year of right, sort of good, rigorous schooling. And the fact that you've got, right, more populations who just need more supports and more special education supports, we have to have systems in place to support those kids if we want to have a society that believes in equity and accessible education for all. And so I think the question becomes, how do you sort of create that set of, right, sort of systems that helps support that safety net and, right, sort of is allows enough innovation to happen in the process? And obviously, like, that's where the bureaucracy comes in, because you end up sort of trying to navigate, right, sort of the system that's uniform when we don't have an education system that can be uniform, because the needs of learners are so different across individual kids, right, even in within the same family, much less within the same zip code. And so it's a question of how do you sort of design then the set of bureaucracy that allows for people to really lean in on innovation and give some level of control over that, while not just throwing the baby out with the bathwater and saying, well, let's just get rid of the bureaucracy and, like, we'll let the markets govern.
So you have, I noticed in your bio notes that you sent over, there was that comment that you referenced earlier about finding the leverage points for driving change, and that you've identified teachers as a, if not the critical leverage point. So I'm curious, how do you, I've heard in my research on education, I've read a lot of critiques around teachers, teachers' unions, teachers that are resistant to standards, teachers sort of, there sometimes is an attempt to, let's say, villainize the teachers as, like, part of the issue. I'm curious, not so much teachers, but teachers' unions and or general, like, collective bargaining structures for teachers. Do you find that to actually be a point of resistance, because the systemic change that's called for could potentially dramatically alter the landscape of what it means to be a teacher, how many teachers we need, the standards for teachers, what teachers are required to do? Or is that not so much an issue?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so in our world, right, we work really well with unions, and we work inside of, you know, CBAs and inside of collective bargaining agreements and the like, because, right, it's obviously a key part of the work of sort of managing the employment workforce. You know, at the end of the day, the rationale behind sort of the union construct in its own place is, where do you have a system where you might have, right, effectively employers taking advantage of large groups of, right, sort of employees? That can happen, certainly in school districts, right? They are often the largest employer in a community, in a county, mm-hmm. right? Is the school board or is the school district? And so I think there's definitely a place, you know, we see misaligned incentives in unions happen. And that's where this sort of vilification, villainization comes in, which is, what is it? How are we sort of taking sort of funds, or how are we sort of using funds for some smaller group, right, versus the entire union base? I think obviously trying to protect against those is a much more nuanced conversation. But, like, the core value, I think, again, from a union lens, would be, like, we're trying to do what's best for kids. And if everybody can agree and anchor back in on what we're trying to do is best for kids, there may be times where what's best for teachers, right, may not be the same thing as what's best for kids. And we have to then sort of draw the line to say, well, how do we sort of negotiate that and figure out what that looks like? Certainly saying, well, what's best for kids is, you know, 12-hour days for teachers, right? And sort of making them, you know, and not paying them well enough, that doesn't feel great. And so it's trying to sort of create some counterbalance there. But I think fundamentally the question is, if we can sort of adjust the system to really think about, how do we align incentives on what is actually the best outcome for kids? And let's be reasonable about sort of how we navigate that and how you create systems and policies that, again, can adapt to the very rapidly changing system we have, that should then help, right, sort of navigate some of these structures. We just don't have those systems in place today, and we just don't have enough, right, sort of ways to revisit the policies, because contract CBAs come up every 4 or 5 years at this point, you know, like school board meeting, like there's just not the, the frequencies of the way the systems are designed to revisit policy decisions, even on an annual basis, in some states it's 7 minutes every 2 years, is so slow relative to the pace that we actually need real progress. And that's, I think, where the fundamental crux comes in, is like, we just don't, it's a hard system to navigate because they're built to be very entrenched and very slow moving.
So do you have, obviously Bloomboard is let's say doing its part to take on one of the leverage points here. Do you have sort of this utopian vision of whether it's 20 or 50 years from now, when the system has been completely re-engineered and the interests of kids come first, but the interests of teachers and parents and all the other stakeholders are aligned to those interests? Like, is there a workable vision, or not even just workable, an ideal vision that you could see as a possibility if we could just get everybody on the same page, or have we not solved that far out yet?
I think we're starting to see a pretty interesting future in a world where, again, we can align career interests and education in a really strong, holistic way. And so if you think about, again, like that, we talked about the shift of like corporations moving into higher ed. And so depending on what you want to do, right, you can imagine going and getting an internship and then working on coursework at your internship rather than like changing copy or paper, right? You're actually doing things that matter, that can be towards your coursework to sort of help you earn credit. And you learn if that's a job that you like. And if it's not, you go do another internship in another place rather than be like, well, I didn't really do, like, I think I'm going to make good money here, so maybe I'll stay. And so the idea that we can start to align, right, if careers really are, right, and sort of that's the way we channel society to do good in the world and to create value for the economy and value for society, right, then I think the more we can sort of align things to the career pathways, and the more we can sort of create educational career pathways that are one and the same, where your job helps you get your degree and your high school, right, internships helps you get credit towards your sort of degree. And that even as, you know, as we have kids in middle school and high school, we're starting to ask questions about, you don't need to know what you want to do yet, but what are the things you like to do? And here's a whole set of stuff and ways you can contribute to society to actually be, right, productive and be helpful. And we're not going to try and, you know, waste time for you to do that. I think that's going to be the really interesting sort of leverage, and that we're going to see a bunch of ways where even high school, like high school kids are pretty brilliant. We don't give them any real credit or value for what we're doing. But like, I've met high school kids who are far smarter and better at everything I do on a daily basis. And so I'm like, okay, you're going to do just fine in the world. And yet we just don't have systems that treat them as such as the sort of average high school kid. And I think that's where there's this sort of, you know, and it's always that, so what's the quote about, so the bigotry of low expectations, but we just don't have high expectations for the way that we've designed those systems and the expectations we put on individual candidates. And I think if we give more autonomy and sort of support to those and really let kids go run and give them credit for the things they're doing, we will see a very interesting shift in terms of, no matter what you want to graduate into or jump into, you're going to be able to get credit for it and be able to sort of get into a career that's going to make you happy and a really valuable contributor to society.
Yeah, I got to say, I love that vision of tying academic matriculation to real world value creation at some level. I think about, I mean, I had an office up in Northern Utah at one point in Orem, and I thought this was brilliant, man. It was a phone sales, I had a digital agency. We did a lot of outbound phone sales. And so I set up a call floor that was right in between Utah Valley University and Brigham Young University. So it was like within 2 miles of each school. So I'm like, I have like 70,000 college students within a 2 mile radius of this office. So I'm going to build a call floor. It'll be easy to cover shifts. We can have the dialers run in 24 hours. We can call foreign countries. Like, this will be amazing. Rude awakening of trying to build an office populated with college students. Because if I'm going to be blunt, these are students that basically came in saying, hey, I'm making my grades. my parents aren't on my case. I can do, I don't have to, I can do whatever the hell I want when I come to work to make money. And it was the most unruly, dysfunctional, like, if I wanted to have a bias, if I wanted to have a low opinion of students, it would be very easy for me to after that experience. But it's because they lived in this bubble where the only thing that mattered was studying and passing tests. And there was no real world character evaluation. There was no credit given to, like you're saying, what does it actually look like to go out into society and be a decent human?
Yep.
And that's crazy to think that we can have somebody that's acing all their tests, they're graduating summa cum laude, and they literally can't even show up on time or carry on a functional, respectful conversation.
Yeah. And I think that's what we're hearing, you know, as we're from more and more employers, is this is the gap in right clinical workforce skills. And so we've done a whole bunch. I'm like, how do you think about those competencies and how early can you start to push those into high schools? Because obviously phones only chip away at that, right? We're only stealing people's attention. We're only stealing their ability to write incoherent sentences and the like, because people are texting. And so I think we have a whole bunch of things we need to counterbalance. And the workplace is the place we could do it best if we can get those systems to really integrate. And I think that's what we're going to spend the next, 5-10 years on. But I think there is a ton of incentive for employers to figure out how to make that work. And so now I think it's just a question of how well higher ed, how well high schools, as the next step, right? High schools are going to continue to push in, and we're seeing this already. It's going to start to push into high schools, and how well your high schools prepare you for the workforce is going to be a big indicator of success in life and the way communities shape up.
Well, it's really interesting, as is so often the case, that the free market is, by your thesis, going to drive a lot of the innovation and solution in a way that that the government can't, that the bureaucracy can't. And nod for capitalism. It gets a bad rap sometimes, I think. But the free market drives a lot more progress than everything else put together. Jason, this is wonderful. Hey, so I don't know how you want to invite the audience into your world. I don't know if you're an aspiring YouTuber or big social media influencer these days. I imagine you're pretty busy running Bloomboard. But maybe share with them about Bloomboard. Like, is there anything the world can come follow along with here?
Yeah, I mean, so we're always looking for interesting. Again, we live in sort of the school district world and the higher ed world, so always trying to find partners on both ends. I'm pretty easy to reach, whether it's on LinkedIn or whether it's on just Jason at Bloomboard. It's sort of an easy way to sort of get in touch, but always happy to sort of share. And again, I think we're finding that this is a world that's going to change even faster in the future here. And so I think it's going to take more and more partnership and more folks to try and figure out how do we really sort of take advantage.
Awesome. Awesome, man. Well, thank you. Thanks for being a guest on the show. It's been wonderful.
Thanks so much. Really appreciate the time.
Of course. And of course, to all you viewers and listeners out there, I tell you this every time. You're the best part of the show. You're why I do it every day. And I'm so glad we got this time together. Till next time.
Hey, it's Jeff here. If you liked this episode of Unlock Your Potential, it would mean so much if you would like and share the episode on whatever platform you're listening or viewing on. And if you really like what we're doing here and you enjoy this podcast, please consider leaving a review. There is so much work that goes into these episodes, and you leaving a positive review lets us know that that work is reaching people, and especially it helps us reach other people. Your review could be the reason that someone else decides to tune in, check out this podcast, and unlock their potential and ultimately level up the quality of their life. So thank you so much for your support and for listening, especially if you like or share or leave a review. Thank you for helping us spread the word, and thank you for unlocking your potential to go make the world and your world a better place.